This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting alternative rock band Cake and the Icelandic rock band Sigur Rós over Memorial Day weekend. Cake and Sigur Rós tickets are available Friday at bendconcerts.com.
I've traveled around this country from shore to shining shore. It really made me wonder the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer a plowing sod and loam. I heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the bolts are stuffed with silver that the farmer sweated for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I heard their bosses saying, "Got no work for you no more." But the banks are made of marble with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie song. Banks are made of marble, and it's true. Well, they're not made of marble today. They're even chintzier than that.
Yeah, they are.
There are very few. A few downtown banks look kind of marble-istic, but they do have all the money that the people sweated for.
Do they?
Yeah, well, it's amazing.
What is money?
What?
What is money today? Money today is some
what
columns.
What is money today?
Some,
what is it,
some
philosophical?
Electronic bits disappear in one column and reappear in another column, and that's money.
Well, yeah, but that money makes it possible for people to get health care and to get houses and to get food and to get jobs. That's really real.
Yeah, there's a few people with columns with a whole bunch of electronic bits, and they want to keep all their bits.
Well,
and
expand
that means
it.
That other people without enough bits, you know, can't go to the dentist or can't go to the doctor.
What are you, a
so
socialist?
What is that?
Are you troublesome socialist?
And it's all just a big illusion,
communist,
Joe.
Communist,
it's
communist.
All propped up by our collective faith that everything will continue to operate as it does.
Oh, we're going to talk about fate and faith?
Well, I don't know. It just seems like it's all been sort of imagined into existence, which is quite a trick, you know. If we can imagine wealth into existence, then why do we have such a big problem with it? Why not just imagine enough so that everybody has everything that they need?
You are extremely weird. You don't get it. You just don't get it.
What don't I get?
Money represents stuff. Stuff represents power. Power represents the ability to make you and me do what we do.
Right, because we get paid so much.
Well,
we get so many little bits
in
our column for come to KBOO.
I'm not talking about KBOO. KBOO's weird. Anyway, this is KBOO. As a matter of fact, 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. We're going to talk about sequester.
Yeah, it's pretty stupid.
I know. Well, it's stupid, but it may be the most significant stupid thing in recent times. 231.
No, it's not significant at all. It's pretty illusory.
Okay.
Illusory.
I don't even get it. I don't even know the word sequester. I'm confused. How did this happen, Abe?
Okay, Joe. Well, a while back in history, human beings realized that instead of living a hunting-gathering lifestyle, they could till a portion of the land and raise crops, and thus generate surplus calories to dramatically increase their rate of reproduction. And thus societies began to grow and organize themselves into governments.
Well, I thought we would get a little more. Okay, go ahead. No, please, continue.
This spot was widely considered by some to be a bad move, that maybe we should have just continued hunting and gathering. There were still others who considered hunting and gathering a bad move, that perhaps we never should have come out of the oceans. Go ahead.
All right, I just have to say that in a conversation I had way back in 19... before most of our audience was born.
What, you interrupted my whimsical history for this?
Yes, I did. For 1967, Gary Snyder and I were talking about this very thing. And I said to him, well, when do you think it all went wrong? And he said, when hunters and gatherers learned to farm, till the soil, and domesticate the animals. Now, go ahead with your whimsical history.
So some time went by. The government thing, the agricultural thing,
yes,
had mixed results. It was a mixed bag. Then some humans figured out how to produce things with industrial production, dramatically reducing their unit cost of production and dramatically increasing the potential to accumulate vast quantities of wealth.
Aha.
By and large, the people rejoiced, for they suddenly, many of them, were free from want. They had enough food. They had devices that eased their labor.
You didn't say low.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Low.
Yes, low.
The people rejoiced.
Yes.
For they saw boundless horizons of plenty before them, stretching off into the future. But it was not to be.
Why not?
Well, because there weren't enough resources to keep making stuff. And the people who controlled the production of stuff were just getting too rich.
Okay, what has this got? What is a sequester? Please.
All right, I'll skip forward then.
Yes,
the
skip forward a bit.
The sequester is really stupid. The sequester happened as a result of a deliberation in 2011. You remember the debt ceiling fight?
Oh, the debt ceiling fight.
Here's a quiz. What is the debt ceiling?
I don't know.
Tell me what the debt ceiling is.
Well, a debt ceiling is an arbitrarily created, really weird, an arbitrarily created limit on debt that reflects not the actual amount of money that Congress has agreed to spend at all, but sort of an arbitrary limit.
Right. A limit that needs to be raised if the Congress has already committed to spending more money than it has.
Right.
So it's a limit that has to be raised in order to meet obligations that have already been entered into.
By Congress.
Right. Right. Why is the debt limit so important? Because if it is exceeded, or if Congress fails to raise it, suddenly the United States is in a position where they might default on its debts.
Faith and credit of the United States.
Faith and credit. And remember earlier in this show, we talked about how the entire thing is propped up by our collective faith that things will continue to operate as they do.
Well, yeah.
The cornerstone of that faith is the United States Treasury bill. It is the safest investment in the world.
Yes.
Because the United States has always repaid those bills and will always repay those bills unless the Congress is really stupid and doesn't raise the debt ceiling to cover the obligations it has entered into.
Right.
The Republicans in Congress threatened to do that in 2011.
Okay.
We came the closest we had ever come to having the credit rating of the United States degraded. In fact, one credit rating agency did, in fact, degrade it.
Oh.
So the deal that was arrived at so that this massive default situation would not come to pass came to be known as the sequester. Basically, this was kicking the can down the road. The Republicans said, well, this deficit is terrible, and we've got to lower it, but we're not going to raise any taxes on the wealthy. We're just not going to do it.
Right.
So they kicked the can down the road. They said, well, we've got to figure out a way to reduce the deficit by the end of 2012. And if we don't do that, then we're going to automatically slash the budget across the board.
Across the board.
That is sequestration.
Yeah, what, 30% slash? Is that right?
Not even that much. No. We're talking about a few billion dollars out of about $3.6 trillion budget.
I see.
Yeah.
And so now we are here. Now, this seems like...
No. We didn't quite get to today.
Oh, sorry.
All right. So this was a deal.
Sorry.
A deal had to be struck by the end of 2012. The end of 2012 approached, and did the wise men of Washington have a deal?
Well, sure.
No.
Oh.
They did not.
Oh.
They decided to kick the can further down the road. They said, okay, we'll give ourselves until March 1st.
But that's this next week.
Yes. That's where we are now.
But Obama participated in this farce?
He did. People on both sides of the aisle sign on to this.
So
they
now,
patted themselves on the back.
So now what happens?
Well, now what happens if they don't come up with a deal by March 1st, then these automatic spending cuts come into effect.
To keep the faith and good credit of the United States.
To keep the faith and good credit of the United States.
And the arbitrary cuts include defense and everything.
Well, they include defense, yes. Now, when I say this thing is all stupid and it's all a big imaginary crisis, that's largely true.
Yes.
But it's a crisis that has real consequences. But don't weep for the Pentagon. Yes, the defense system will be cut, but, you know, don't cry any crocodile tears for them.
Well, but they have the machines. The
yeah,
big
but
machines.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Machines.
What is the things that are facing cuts are things like food safety inspections.
Who needs that?
Government money for scientific research.
Not necessary. We know everything there is to know.
Programs that help poor kids get a good education.
Poor kids shouldn't have a good education. They should be wage slaves.
Money that helps operate shelters for homeless people.
Homeless people are losers.
And money that helps firefighters fight fires on federal lands.
Firefighters fighting fires on federal lands are foolish.
Say that three times fast again. Yeah, so this has some real consequences. It's really stupid. It's an arbitrary decision with an arbitrary deadline.
Yes.
And what's most stupid about it, you might be wondering?
Wait. What is most stupid about it?
What is most stupid?
Yes.
Okay, if you ask the average person on the street, what is the biggest fiscal / economic problem facing the United States? What do you think that answer would be?
I have no idea.
Most people would say to you the deficit is the problem.
Well, yeah, apparently that's the popular idea, deficit.
The government doesn't
limit its spending the way I do at home.
That's right. But a government is not a household. I'm glad you brought that up because that analogy is paraded around Washington all the time. Oh, you wouldn't run your house like this, would you?
No.
You wouldn't keep your household endlessly spiraling into debt, would you?
Well, you can't.
No. But governments are not households. Here's why. Governments in times of extended unemployment and depression, which is what we're experiencing.
Yes.
Can borrow money and spend it to put people to work.
Yes.
Deficit spending in a time of economic crisis is how you get out of the crisis. Not by cutting spending, not by narrowing the deficit, but by borrowing more and spending more in the short term.
Well, wait a minute.
So that you can emerge from this problem in the long term.
That can't be true. All Germany, the leader of the European Union, all the big shots in Northern Europe, say that austerity is the solution.
No, austerity is not the solution, and we need only look as far as Europe to find that out. Look at Greece. Look at Ireland. Look at Britain. Look at Germany. All of these people have reacted with that same piece of false wisdom. The way to get out of your crisis is to balance your budget. It ain't true. In fact, it makes things worse because we don't have a deficit crisis. We have a crisis of demand. The best way to get out of the hole we're in is to put people to work so they have money in their pockets, that they go out into the community and they circulate. They buy things. They pay for goods. They pay for services. My income, to a large extent, is your income. Your income is your neighbor's income. The money, the economy hums when this money is circulating throughout it, when there's a high level of demand. That's how we get out of the economic
hole. Wait a minute. Are you saying that the economics is fundamentally like what I learned in high school long ago? That it's about supply and demand?
And demand, yes.
Demand.
Supply and demand.
We don't talk demand no more.
Now, see, the entire paradigm, the entire scope of the discourse in Washington has fallen into this false paradigm that we must balance the budget. We must reduce the deficit. It's the only way to fiscal health.
Well, whether you want to burden the children with a future debt.
No, I don't want to burden the children with the future debt.
Ah.
It is important that we eventually address the debt the United States has accumulated. But that time is not now. That time is not when we're experiencing long-term unemployment.
Ah.
The time to spend more money is now.
But we're not going to do that.
No, we're not going to do that.
Obama doesn't seem to want to, doesn't have the cajones?
No, he has bought into this framework entirely. He's talking about how his plan lowers the deficit more than the Republicans' plan does.
So it's a big fight over who's going to lower the deficit?
Drunk the Kool-Aid. And I think he knows better. That's what's particularly frustrating. I think he knows better.
Well, you may be giving him more credit than he deserves.
No, remember he tried and succeeded to pass a big fiscal stimulus bill during his first term.
Yeah, that's true. So it wasn't big enough.
It wasn't big enough, and it didn't stimulate demand enough.
Right.
A couple years ago, he introduced something called the American Jobs Act, which would have done exactly what I just described. It would have paid Americans to go to work building infrastructure.
Which we need.
Which we need. But it never made it out of the Republican-controlled Congress. Never made it out of committee.
Wow. So,
I think Obama knows better.
Well, we have this sequester, a word I never heard until recently.
Yeah, it's a stupid word for a stupid idea.
Well, what does it
stupid,
mean?
What is the word sequester?
What does it even mean?
I really don't know. Do you want me to look up the word sequester?
I want you to look up.
Why don't we take a phone call while we look it up?
You know, you understand, folks, Abe has all control of all knowledge.
That's true, I do.
Because he has the Mac thing. Okay, let's take Sean. Welcome to Sequesterland.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Now that I'm here in sequester land,
yes.
Maybe I can reshape the debate a little bit.
Sure.
You know, it's really frustrating. Instead of talking about, you know, having various changes in income taxes, sales taxes, payroll taxes, so on and so forth, Ronald Reagan's former budget director, David Stockman, talked about a wealth tax, a one-time wealth tax. He was on 60 Minutes a couple years ago. And his idea was you take the top 2% of wealth holders in the United States and you impose this one-time 15% wealth tax.
What would that yield, aside from angry rich people?
I believe he said that it would cut the national debt in half.
Whoa.
So we're talking about a serious chunk of change. I would go even higher than that. You know, if we're going to be transitioning from an economy based on consumerism to a steady state economy, if we want a planet to continue to live on, we really are going to have some sort of massive Green New Deal. And the only way we're going to pay for that is to redistribute wealth in the form of these massive wealth taxes. This would also solve the problem of all the Wall Street criminality that has redistributed wealth upward over the last 5 years.
But wait a minute. This is not right because you're taxing the job creators.
Oh, yes, the job creators.
Oh, jeez.
We, the 47%, the parasites. I think they have that a little bit turned around. Like, Richard Wolff was on Bill Moyers the other day.
Yes.
And he was talking about how, you know, as productivity has gone up over the last 30, 40 years, the richest 1 or 2% have been, you know, scraping off all the profit, and they've accumulated all this wealth. And so this notion that the money just isn't there is a myth. What we need is a wealth tax.
Wages have not kept up with productivity. We are far more productive now, workers in America, than we were 20 or 30 years ago. But we are not earning a proportionately larger wage.
Well, in fact, the wages have gone down over the past 30 years in real dollars.
So you're right. All of that excess wealth is being skimmed off the top.
Right. And it was heartbreaking for me. Normally, I tune into Bread and Roses on Friday nights because it's an excellent source of radical leftist politics.
Yeah, good show.
But last Friday, they actually had a financial planner on. They had some Wall Street person from West Lynn, Oregon, was on Bread and Roses of all places.
Okay. West Lynn's all right, you know. It's a place where African Americans can live as opposed to Lake No Negro. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, like, people need to get this in their mind that Wall Street, you know, the super rich, they are the enemy. We should be divesting ourselves from Wall Street. We should be taking our money out of pension funds, getting union money out of these Wall Street pension funds. Divestment. You know, totally separate yourself from this, you know, this plutocracy. You know, it's like there's this book called Liar's Poker by Michael Lewis, and it really gets into the source of securitization and how this entire second Great Depression was brought on by Wall Street and the hunger for mortgages and other financial products that they could securitize. So it was just heartbreaking for me to hear someone on Bread and Roses promoting the idea of, you know, getting into Wall Street, getting into mutual funds. So, I mean, that's the last thing. You know, if you look, and black and brown folks have no net worth. Their wealth has been annihilated, while this tiny percentage of rich white people are still clinging to this Wall Street model. And we need to divest ourselves, completely separate ourselves from this whole notion of this, you know, Wall Street financialized economy.
Okay, well,
yeah, talk about imagining wealth into existence.
Yeah,
thanks, guys.
I really appreciate your comment. Listen, what did you discover, Abe?
All right, sequester is both a noun and a transitive verb.
Oh, that's really sleazy.
Well, no, it's not.
Well, yeah,
a lot of words double as nouns and verbs.
You think so?
Yeah, sequester as a noun means separation or isolation.
Okay.
As a transitive verb, it means to set aside or to segregate.
So it's just one of them fancy words for messing all everybody over?
Yeah, essentially, in this context, it means sequester means to screw everyone over.
I see. Well, I'm glad we have that clear. We have a lot of calls. A number to call is 231-8187.
Before we do that.
We're talking about sequester. Before we do that.
We were talking just a moment ago about supply and demand. And
yes.
You brought up the term job creators.
Yes.
All right. The job.
Well, I was being silly.
You were. You were being silly, yes, but that term is tossed around in a very non-ironic, non-silly way by people who really ought to know better.
Yeah?
The myth of the job creator, that we can't raise taxes on rich people in a time of economic distress because it will kill the economy, is patently false.
Yeah, but just remember, corporations are people, my friend.
I'll believe corporations are people when the state of Texas executes one. All right?
Okay.
Now, we've done this thought experiment before on the show, and I think we should do it again.
Okay.
This is how you disprove the job creator's myth, okay? Let's say you're a job creator, Joe.
I am a job creator.
You own factories all over the country.
I own factories.
You make widgets.
I make excellent widgets.
Now, the economy is in the tank. Nobody's buying your widgets.
Why don't they buy my widgets?
Because they're out of work. They don't have money to spend on widgets.
Ah.
There is a lack of demand for your widgets.
Ah.
Right. But as a job creator, we don't want to raise your taxes, right?
No.
In fact, we're going to cut your taxes.
Why?
Because that will stimulate growth.
Oh.
That's what the Republicans and conservatives say.
Okay.
We cut your taxes, it'll stimulate growth.
Okay.
So now let's say you've got $10 million extra dollars.
Yes.
What are you going to do with that?
Well, I'll invest it in some secure...
No, wait.
No.
You're a job creator. Aren't you going to hire people to make widgets?
Well, no. Nobody's buying widgets.
Oh. So cutting your taxes doesn't actually create jobs.
Not unless there's a demand for my widgets.
Now, what if we did this? What if we raised your taxes, Mr. Job Creator?
Uh-oh.
And what if we used that money to put people to work building solar farms and wind farms? And they had money and they wanted to go buy widgets.
Huh.
Would you then hire more people to build widgets?
Well, yeah, obviously, in that circumstance.
There's more demand for your widgets. That's how it works.
Well, so what you're really saying is that what is the problem here is that people don't have enough money to buy the stuff.
Yes, yes. The problem is not the deficit. The problem is people ain't got jobs and they ain't got no money.
They ain't got the do-re-mi.
That's right.
Oh, no.
That's the problem.
So to solve this problem, one would tax the wealthy and use that money to pay other corporations to build highways and build high-speed rail and build wind farms and so on.
Yes.
Oh, that's so un-American. That's so 1930s.
Yeah, it is so 1930s. And you know what? It worked.
It did, didn't it?
It did.
Well, except, the war.
Well, yeah.
The war was...
We'll get to that more in a moment. Engineer Steve just handed me a note. Says Montana has legislation pending that would let corporations actually vote.
What? No.
Well, they're people too, right?
Only according to Mitt Romney, and look what happened to him.
Right. Let's go to the phones.
All right.
Who's up? Ed, good morning.
Good morning. You know, another myth is that the United States actually is paying its debt. You know, if I have to borrow money to pay a bill, I'm not really paying that bill.
Well, you're paying the bill. You're just transferring money from one source to another.
Yeah, you're redistributing, but you're not really paying a bill if you're borrowing money to... in order to do it.
No, you're just servicing interest.
The United States has been doing that for quite a long time. Luckily for us, there's still people out there, or countries out there, that are willing to buy our treasuries. But at some point, they're going to realize that bill is never going to get paid, and we're going to have a currency collapse.
So what do you want to do to...
Fortunately for the United States, we have the biggest military, bigger than... most other countries combined.
Well, bigger than the 11 biggest, actually.
That's really the only reason that we're able to do this. But at some point, the world's going to realize that the U.S. dollar is not worth anything.
Nah, they'll never realize that. Because if they try to realize that, we'll beat them up.
Well, for a while we will. And I'm sure we're going to have a war in the not-too-distant future, probably in Iran or over Iran.
Yeah, I think having a war with Iran is a very good strategy. We in Israel can go and beat up the rest of the world.
Right, but don't you think it's very likely that that's going to happen with all the rhetoric that's going on?
Well, it's a very strong possibility, particularly when the United States, which has a vast nuclear arsenal, says that no new nuclear arsenals can exist, even though North Korea already has one and a missile that can probably dump a nuclear weapon on Los Angeles.
Or Portland,
for that matter. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thanks very much for the call.
I think he's got a...
I think so.
Ooh.
Oh, let's take another call. Who do we have? Jane, good morning.
Good morning. The debate in Washington is between one totalitarian oligarchy and another totalitarian oligarchy. Would you like a solution?
I'll let your assertion go, and I would like to hear your solution.
Restore federalism, decentralize the economy.
Mm.
That would equate to the people controlling the means of production at the local level. That would marginalize the oligarchy in D.C.
How would you do that?
How would people control the means of production at the local level short of seizing them from the ownership
through
class?
Tax and regulatory policy at the local level.
So you're talking about legal seizure, essentially.
No, well, basically the Constitution is still in existence. What happened was when we gave the central government the authority to tax the people directly and mm-hmm. to regulate the economy, that equated to making an oligarchy. We created an oligarchy when we gave the central government control of the means of production. We got bamboozled.
The Commerce Clause, already empowers the government to regulate the economy.
That's not true.
It is true.
You got to go back to Jefferson. Trust me on this. I've studied this for.
Jefferson was not at the Constitutional Convention. Jefferson had nothing to do with the drafting of the Constitution.
Jefferson worked through Madison. Madison was the father of the Constitution.
Yes, that's true. They were very close friends. But Jefferson was in France.
At the time. Which is a long ways away in those days.
Do you know about the second American Revolution of 1800, which established our federal system of government, which gave us the centralized, and that was over the spending clause, which limited the central government. It limited to its enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. It kept the government divided, which made the central government a servant of the people. When it was expanded beyond its constitutional limitations, the central government became the people's master.
All right, I'm really, for the sake of your argument, I'm willing to stipulate your point right now that there's two oligarchies in Washington, and your claim that returning the control of the means of production to people at the local level will solve this problem. Let's get back to that. Tell us how that's going to solve the problem.
Well, it gives the people power. And what I mean by that, it gives the people power. They have all kinds of different, that's what liberty or freedom or the self-determination of the people was all about. People could come together in community and there would be no higher authority than that community.
You're a socialist, James.
No, I'm a Jeffersonian agrarian.
Kind of sounds like socialism to me.
Socialism equates to a centrally controlled economy. Jeffersonian agrarianism equates to a decentralized economy.
We're debating
totalitarianism versus totalitarianism on the national level. The oligarchy has us divided in a way where we aren't even getting to where it's federalism or the restoration of our federal system of government versus totalitarian rule. And Jeffersonian agrarianism was marginalized.
Well, look, James, here,
thank you for listening to me, for once.
Well, yeah, but listen, I think it's really important to understand that you're not talking as if there's really any power involved or that money has power any of the things. The Constitution is a piece of paper unless the people support it. I mean, without going into your argument historically, which is complex and needs a real analysis, but without doing any of that, the fact of the matter is that the money and the money power is in the hands of a very small number of people whose interests are not co-existent with yours and mine. I don't see how anything in the way of change, as you advocated, even if that change would work, which I could argue with you about, it's just not going to happen, man. Not going to happen.
If the people unite, it will.
The people united will never be defeated is sort of true in the abstract, and yet the people united are always almost defeated.
But see, the thing of it is they've got us. We are literally like the Weimar Republic right now. They have us divided in the fact an oligarchy has us divided into a bunch of factions. They are ready to do to us what they did to Nazi Germany. In fact, I am convinced that they plan to murder us by the tens of millions. I am
convinced of that.
Why? Well, so, James, it's an enormous jump between your constructionist argument about the change in power relations in 1800.
These are neo-Stalinists that are running our country. They are going to do to us what they did, what Stalin did to the Ukraine.
Okay, I think at that point we'll
leave it there.
Leave it for the moment and go on with our conversation. All right.
I hope I get a bunk in the concentration camp next to you, Joe.
Oh, yeah. What do you think? We can be real buddies?
Okay.
All right.
The sequester.
Sequester.
Which is what will happen on March 1st if no resolution is reached.
Yeah. Well, how much will it matter?
Now, we talked about the poor folks and government services that will be impacted.
Yeah, we don't care about them. They don't spend money.
That axe will also fall on the military.
Ooh.
Now, this is very interesting. The Republican orthodoxy is that government spending does not create jobs, except if that government spending is on things like tanks and planes and missiles and drones and stuff.
Yeah.
That kind of spending creates jobs. So you have the really ironic specter right now of Republican Congress critters running around saying, oh, my God, the sequester is going to kill jobs by slashing the defense budget.
Well, but that's changing. Just yesterday, it seemed like the Republicans were moving away from that position and saying, okay, cut the military.
Some of them are, mostly the very conservative Tea Party base.
Ah.
See, I think that's the chickens coming home to roost right there. If you're a mainstream money class Republican and you make a devil's bargain with these fire-breathing Tea Party types, this is what comes to pass.
Burn throats.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. Now, we're talking about an infinitesimal cut to the defense budget. The Pentagon will go along just fine. If we end the endless war. But what's interesting here is by raising a stink about the jobs that are going to be lost when these cuts hit the defense industry, the Republicans are making a tacit admission that, yes, government spending does create jobs.
Yes, you're right.
So by extension, one should be able to make an argument that says something like this. If we can put people to work building drones and bombers and tanks and stuff, then we can put people to work building bridges and repairing roads and schools and building fiber optic networks and researching green energy and all this different stuff.
And fighting disease.
And fighting disease.
Fighting poverty and stuff.
This is why I'm particularly frustrated with the president here, because, like I said, I think he really knows better. I think he grasps this basic macroeconomic tenet that I learned back in freaking high school, that if the government stimulates demand, the economy grows.
I don't know what he knows. I don't know him, and I've never had a conversation with him.
No.
And his wife gave the award for the best picture, and that's what I know.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks.
Yeah.
Who's next?
Bangs, and she has bangs.
Yes. Larry, you're up next.
Hey, Abe and Joe, great show.
Thank you.
I just want to focus a little on the economics of it, and Abe, you touched on it in the intro. And just for a broad picture, I think there is a ruse on this whole sequester and the idea of debt. And the prize is Social Security and Medicare.
Now you're getting to where our heads are at.
The thing about it is, Abe, is that unlike this Germany, Greece, the state of California, every household and every corporation, the U.S. government can print money. None of those other entities can print their own money.
Right.
And when the private sector is not spending money, the corporations, mm-hmm. and when the private individuals are in debt and can't spend money, the government must spend money or, say, print money in order to prime the pump to get the economy rolling again. Now, the government, in fact, is printing money, but instead of using that money to create jobs, they are giving it to the banks to bail the banks out because the books on the banks, they are mostly insolvent. And if the government was serious, the politicians were serious about reviving the economy and helping the citizens and creating jobs, they would do that. But they're more concerned about Wall Street and grabbing Social Security. Now, the people who would say that the government can't print money because it causes inflation, and that's a bad thing, that is true once full employment is met.
Yes.
The government can print as much money as they want as long as there's no full employment. Once full employment is met, then inflationary things start to affect the economy.
Right,
so,
right. But while we're still on that curve approaching full employment, the growth in demand combined with the growth in supply that demand causes will mitigate those inflationary pressures.
Exactly
right. So while we're recovering, we don't have to worry so much about inflation.
Exactly correct. And that's why Obama knows this, these people know this, but their plan is not, they're not concerned about debt. They're concerned about the grand prize, and that is Social Security to save Wall Street. That's the last big source of money that Wall Street needs. There's no other source of money. All the pension funds, they're being underfunded by the corporations. The last giant fund is Social Security.
So, I would dispute you only on one small choice of words. I think that's the last great source of money that Wall Street wants, not that it necessarily needs.
Well, I think it needs it in a sense that with their exposure with the derivatives, the combined private sector debt of like $500 trillion, they don't even know what it is. It's like 10 times the amount of the world GDP, and that's why all this money that the government is printing is being given to the banks, because their books are toast. But anyway, I think you guys are doing a great job, and more focus on technical economics I think would help all of us, because we just assume that the Bernankes of the world and even the Paul Krugmans know what they're doing, and they're no more than the Aztec high priests, and everybody else is sitting back, banking on them, and their interest is not our interest.
Oh, thanks for the call.
Hey, that's
man.
A great call. Thank you very much.
Yeah, take care.
Yeah, maybe all we need to do is throw someone down the steps of a pyramid and make a sacrifice.
We have to cut their heart out.
Right.
That's the important part.
That is important.
All right.
Right, you do it without cutting a heart out. You've screwed it up.
Oh, well, yeah, you ended up broken bones and moaning.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Professor and author Jane Rhodes speaks on Framing the Black Panthers. She is the author of Framing the Black Panthers.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. They really were framed.
And they were.
And they're still being framed.
She is the author of Framing the Black Panthers, the spectacular rise of a black power icon. At 10, here Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the battle to save the U.S. Post Office from being privatized. Also, deepening the conversation on race, we feature excerpts from a powerful documentary, Cracking the Codes. At 11 on stage and studio host D. May Roberts features Philip Ken Gotanda, one of the most prolific and successful playwrights in the country. And at 11:30, host Ava Lake interviews Rita Robillard, who has a show called And Then Again, Riffs on Forests and Time at Ogden Gallery this month. All this and more coming up today on KBOO.
Well, yeah, see, we have good programming.
Yeah, we do have good programming.
Okay.
He was right that Social Security and Medicare are the grand prizes.
I really do think that. The only conspiracy theory I really buy into is the idea, which I think is awfully true, that a whole lot of really bad-minded people want to grab off the great inventions of the 1930s, which are common to many modern industrial societies, and take that money and privatize it and put it in their pockets and use it in ways that we best not
Indeed.
Think about.
They've been trying to undo the New Deal since it was enacted.
Well, really?
And they came very, very close during the Bush administration, and unfortunately, we haven't regained any of that lost ground.
No, that's true. I mean, I earlier mentioned the fact that people's real wages have actually gone down in the last 30 years, and it's really true. So that means their buying power is lower, except for the use of debt, which is the whole other issue. And the consequence of all of that is to make us all debtors and to essentially not make us great producers. And there ain't jobs, therefore.
Yeah. Now, Social Security pays out around $1 trillion every year to its beneficiaries.
Yeah.
That goes directly from the government to those people.
Yeah.
There's no interlocutor. There's no intermediary.
Right. And it's insurance that the people who worked for it paid for it.
Their entire working lives.
Yeah.
Now,
it's not a debt. It's not a part of the budget. It's the Social Security is, until Ronald Reagan messed with it, is essentially should have been and it could be a separate account dedicated to that purpose. There's no reason to emerge
it. It still largely is.
Yeah, even though he brought it into the measuring.
Right, right. Well, the point I'm getting at is that the push to privatize Social Security means that instead of that money going directly to beneficiaries, it would pass through brokers' hands who would be able to charge something like 3 to 5% on every one of those $1 trillion every year.
Yeah, but see, that's why that's they job want privatization. Creation.
That's not job creation. that's lining one's nest. That's lining one's wallet. That's buying another yacht. That's getting yourself a summer home in Paris.
I would like a summer home in Paris.
Yes, I'm sure you would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who's next? Randy, good morning.
Hi. I want to expand on the point that a previous caller made about wealth taxes. The leading expert on that is a man at NYU, Ed Wolf, not Richard Wolf, but Ed Wolf.
Uh-huh.
And the point that he has made, not only have wages declined the last 30 years, but actually the assets held, the number of people in the U.S. with zero assets has increased.
Mm-hmm.
It's now 40%.
Wow.
Virtually all of the increases in assets the last 30 years have gone to the top 1%. That means families with more than $5 to $8 million in assets per family.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about this is that's important. You know, there's the idea of, well, the wealthy are job creators. Not really. It's the smaller investors are more likely to invest in tangible assets like tools, factories, and buildings than the really big investors.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tax the really big investors and you give the small investors a break, that's job creation. And Ralph Bader has endorsed this basic idea, a 1% to 2% tax on assets over $5 million. It would leave 99% of the population completely alone.
I'm for it. I have to say, I have always been an advocate of either eating or taxing the rich.
But that goes back. I mean, see, the thing is that when you look at the New Deal, that's the one big thing they left out. Okay, you know, the Socialist Party platform of 1932 had as one of its planks an asset tax.
Right.
Roosevelt adopted just about everything else. This is like the one line that he would not cross.
Well, and he was a patrician himself. Let's not forget.
And it was essentially an unspoken deal. That allowed the wealthy to tolerate these changes, which later became typifications of the ways that Europe redistributed wealth to the poorer people for a long time.
Well, the thing about it is the redistribution in recent years has been more from the upper middle to the low than from the upper to the low.
Right. No, I agree with you. That's absolutely true.
And the thing about it is, I mean, we're going back to what, you know, Huey Long was the big rival of Roosevelt back in the 30s.
Yes.
And that was his program, was a very high-end asset tax.
Right.
And I think that we're really now at the point where that needs to be reconsidered. I'd suggest doing a whole program on this.
Well,
I mean, I just think there's enough there that you could do a program simply on this whole issue.
What do you think the likelihood in the United States is of some kind of a transfer tax that would take significant wealth away from the 0.01%?
Let me put it this way. The question is can we persist as a Democratic or Republican government without it? I mean, we may, you know, transition to an overt oligarchy at some point,
uh-huh.
And that may be one route. But I think the thing about it is right now we have a situation where the people on the left are ignorant about these issues. I mean, people on the left are thinking, "Oh, gee, we're going to increase taxes on people making $100,000 a year, and that's going to solve the problem." I'm sorry,
no, it's not.
Bill Gates wants an income tax in the state of Washington. Why? Because it's going to leave him alone. His income relative to his assets is tiny. So yes, of course he wants an income tax. It's going to tax competition.
Huh.
Well, listen, thank you very much for the call.
No, and I must say that I think taxing the highest end a significant but small percentage really does make sense. Thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, thanks.
One
thing Roosevelt did that I really admire him for was that he passed a windfall profits tax in the midst of the Second World War.
Right.
He said there would be no wartime millionaires. He decided, and we by extension, that it was immoral to excessively profit during a time of war. It would be nice to see something like that again.
Yeah, but that windfall profit tax was relatively limited. And in fact, the war did create a new class of millionaires and the military industrial state.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Okay, fine. We want to hear from you. We're talking about the sequester, 231-8187.
Vernon, good morning.
Good morning. Magnificent discussion you gentlemen are having.
Thank you very much.
I think the problem is obviously huge. And there's no question that this debt-based economy that we're living in cannot bring a good life to most people. It's nice to look back at the liberal dream that our parents' generation almost built, and it would be wonderful if we could get the Senate to ratify the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then we'd all have economic rights as the Roosevelts proposed. But right now, we've got the best politicians that money can buy, and frankly, they're not interested in working for the people because they're making the do-re-mi working for the elite.
That's true.
So the question is, how do we exert our power to get to a place that makes everyone better off?
Okay, how?
I'm not sure I have the answer. let me offer a suggestion.
Sure, go ahead.
I think we have to think big and speak simply. And my favorite bumper sticker is, it's time for a jubilee.
Oh, you want to forgive all debt?
I want to forgive all debt. I want to release all prisoners. I want to bring home all the soldiers. And I want to demand it. And we demand it by saying, we are not playing your game anymore. We're not paying the banks another damn dime.
That's some kind of biblical thing.
All our homes at once.
Now I got to confess, I haven't thought through the full ramifications of across-the-board forgiveness of debt. But it sounds like a heap of fun.
I live in a small town.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I can go down and talk to my sheriff. And I can say, look, if everybody in this town says they're not going to pay the banks, whose side are you on?
What did he say?
Well, she said...
Oh, you got me. What did she say?
She was taken under consideration when she heard from everybody in town.
I think she feels fairly safe in that.
She's very, very much in favor of popular control of government, and she is very uncomfortable being an enforcement arm for the banks. Luckily, we don't have huge numbers of foreclosures in this area, and most of them are on slimy, cheap landlords.
If I may ask, what part of the state are you in?
Corvallis.
Ah, okay.
Corvallis is a model for the world. We realize that, and we're working hard on being even better.
Despite the fact that the Oregon State is there. Okay, never mind.
Hey, it's a nice school.
Okay, man.
Hey, listen, thank you very much.
Thank you. I think the whole concept of Jubilee is interesting.
It is really interesting.
Having a biblical tone to it.
Maybe we need to talk about that in the future.
We could.
Maybe sit down and sort of parse that out.
Wait, somebody's...
Who's next? Uh-oh.
Oh.
Marla.
Marla.
Good morning.
Welcome, Marla.
No, this is Michael.
Michael. We got Michael.
Welcome, Michael, also.
I've been called a lot of things, but never Marla.
Oh, what can I say, man?
Welcome to KBOO.
I'm on disability, and I'm very frightened. I've watched my income shrink in the last few years.
Uh-huh.
Right now, I have peanut butter, rice, and spaghetti to eat for the rest of the month.
Well, but that's a heart-healthy diet.
Well, I've got my carbs and my protein, yeah.
Well,
I got coffee. I got to have the coffee.
Really?
I mean, yeah. But I think I'm in with the guy that said it's a ruse. It's this shock doctrine, artificial catastrophe that they create. And it's always us that have to give something up. And we don't have anything left to give up. I mean, I live indoors. I've been homeless. I don't want to be homeless again.
Yes.
I have PGE, so my electric bill is like $200 a month in the winter. So, I'm scared. I don't hear our voices being heard in the mainstream media anyway. We keep talking about the middle class, but there's a lot of very poor people here. I think $730 a month qualifies as poverty. I'm not sure what the line is. Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, but it does. And in fact, the real, one of the most interesting things is that I talked about how the real income has dropped by 30% or something. I can't remember the exact numbers. But more than that, the hidden rising costs of stuff, which are not generally measured, are enormous and really do impact ordinary people.
Yeah, and I mean, even food boxes are you know, it's supposed to be like last for 2 weeks or for a few days. Now, I don't want to get off subject, but here's something I've been trying to get people to break a story on, because I used to get Social Security at a bank. What they do is they get the money on the 25th or 26th.
Mm-hmm.
We get the money on the 1st and the 3rd. Not only do they get interest, but a check will bounce and they charge you $35.
No, I think you're actually pointing out the whole thing of the way in which banks, many ways in which banks make money is just on that little bit of slippage, that little bit of opportunity to invest that money.
Yeah, people like me don't see how pennies add up to billions. It's just, it's amazing. And it's like you're saying, they're trying to steal Social Security. It is solvent. And I have such a hard time convincing, like, my friends and stuff. They really believe the propaganda that's, you know, bringing us down, and it's got nothing to do with it. I don't know if they even have the money to pay for the last two wars. I'm sure they're trying to steal it for that, you know.
No, they didn't. That's why they borrowed so much.
Yeah, they just need to leave it alone. But
in fact, the war's in Iraq.
I can't afford cable, luckily, so I get my news from a little clock radio that I have, so I don't always get KBOO. It just depends on what the radio decides and what the weather is. But
you always know what time it is.
Huh?
You always know what time it is.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, listen, thank you so much. Appreciate your comments this morning.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Good hearing you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I think it's really important. Part of the mythology that really has been promulgated by the powerful, and in fact the powerful have tried to manipulate it into truth, is that Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are too expensive, and they're actually insurance policies paid for by the people who invest as workers in America, and that's being ignored, and it's being turned into some kind of a benefit for poor people. Which it never was.
An entitlement.
Yeah, right. The very term.
Nonsense.
Hey, you know, I pay FICA. Other people pay FICA. When we pay FICA, we're paying our insurance premium.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah, so it's not an entitlement. It's something you bought.
Yeah, and I'm entitled to have it and use it.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so now sequester. Back to our original topic.
Well, the guy mentioned the war. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were the first we have fought entirely on borrowed money.
Right. And like both Korea and Vietnam before the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in fact, these are wars of choice. The United States was not in any of these cases directly threatened.
No.
And a little bit, in a way, global theory-wise for Korea, but certainly not for Vietnam, and definitely not for these two wars. In fact, as people now know, Iraq was based on lies and really was about having our footprint heavy in the Middle East and getting all the oil.
Yes.
And Afghanistan was supposed to be, we're going to get Osama bin Laden, but he in the sea. Forever, and it should have ended a long time ago. The idea that we're going to reform, that we're going to take on the role of reforming Afghanistan, and not allowing the Afghanis to reform themselves. I mean, that's a bad idea. It's a bad idea in the 19th century with the British. It's a bad idea. It brought the Soviet Union to economic ruin, in our own times. And now we're doing the same thing. Hello.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing.
Dumb.
So those wars were fought entirely with borrowed money at the same time that the very wealthiest among us enjoyed massive tax cuts.
Really?
So to hear Republicans right now wringing their hands and clutching their pearls about the deficit is laughable.
I want to know about clutching pearls.
I'll have to tell you about that sometime.
Okay.
Let's go back to the phones. Marla, good morning.
Good morning, fellas. Heavy lifting this life is, right?
Indeed. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I have what I think is just basically a mathematical question, and this is something, it may sound like devil's advocate. It isn't meant to. It's just trying to get some more info.
Sure.
And what a group of good callers so far. It's my very, very sharp bunch. And here comes my question. How long would taxing the rich at a high rate keep that money supporting the economy if no jobs are created, or in fact, even if they are created long term?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, you would have to couple those tax increases with legislation legislation that is specifically designed to put people to work.
Yeah, I mean, really, if you did it in a rational way, and you created the things that make the economy work more effectively and provide jobs. For example, the development of new power resources, solar and wind, the creation of high-speed rail networks to replace the dumb aeroplane thing, a whole bunch of projects like that, road projects, bridges, good health care, a lot of stuff we don't really have. You would, in the end, have a wealthier, healthier population in an economy that would be highly competitive. So the real cost would probably be, in terms of real dollars, even to the rich, virtually nil.
So that long-term, I guess here, this is kind of what I'm thinking. Does it seem logical that that 1%, 2% would at some point be bled out so that they would no longer even want to put... I heard what you said before, but that they may no longer at some point want to invest even in the market that they support the country by apparently the stock exchange passing coupons back and forth. would that or would that not affect their... whatever decision they use, their risk-taking capabilities
so
or whatever.
You're saying, what if the wealthy, after we've taxed them for a while, decide to pout and take all their money and invest it in cheap labor elsewhere?
It's the Ayn Rand fear.
If that were the case, and people, you go ahead and call me socialist for saying this if you want to, that's fine.
Socialist.
Then it would, I think, be the government's responsibility, instead of contracting with people to build the infrastructure we're talking about, directly hire people to build the infrastructure we're talking about.
Okay, all right. Okay, good. And one other thing, I just want to make a comment about...
I have to make it real quick.
President Johnson created the surtax. Is that still in effect on goods? You were discussing that.
I don't know.
That's a good question. Yeah. We can't answer it because we're out of time.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you for the call. It is KBOO. We talked sequester, and you talked back, and we are really glad you did that, and stay tuned.
And we didn't bore anyone to death.
I don't know that we did or didn't.
I hope not.
We can't tell.
We'll be back next week.
All right. Real or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Tuesday, February 26th at 6 p.m. Tune in, turn on, and remember, 45 years of KBOO Community Radio. This month, we'll hear from Bob Bailey and Sheila Rubin, who were both involved in the early days of KBOO. Tune in, turn on, and remember is a monthly series that will run through the year 2013, KBOO's 45th anniversary year. If you have a story about KBOO that you want to share for this series, contact KBOO's station navigator at navigator@kboo.org or find out more at kboo.fm/stories. And remember to listen Tuesday, February 26th at 6 p.m. only on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on Alternative Radio, professor and author Jane Rhodes speaks on Framing the Black Panthers. She is the author of Framing the Black Panthers, The Spectacular Rise of a Black Power Icon. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the battle to save the U.S. Post Office from being privatized. Also, deepening the conversation on race, we feature excerpts from a powerful documentary, Cracking the Codes. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Dimay Roberts features Philip Khan Gotanda, one of the most prolific and successful playwrights in the country. And at 11:30, host Ava Lake interviews Rita Robillard, who has a show called And Then Again, Riffs on Forests and Time at Ogden Gallery this month. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Up next, alternative radio. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting alternative rock band Cake and Icelandic rock band Sigur Rós over Memorial Weekend. Cake and Sigur Rós tickets are available Friday at bendconcerts.com.
Within a year of the party's founding, the central leadership in Oakland had put in place a growing media machine that engaged in a complex relationship with the mainstream media. Each had a powerful motivation to interact with the other. The Panther story was a saleable commodity, and increasingly the Black Panthers viewed their media visibility as a means of survival, as government agencies tried increasingly repressive tactics to silence them. Kathleen Cleaver said, quote, "In general, we figured being in the news kept us from being killed."
That's Jane Rhodes, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jane Rhodes, Framing the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers, founded by Huey Newton and Bobby Seale in 1966, made an extraordinary impact on politics and culture. They captured the imagination of a generation and achieved iconic status with their berets, clenched fists, leather jackets, guns, and their trademark slogan, "All Power to the People." Above all, despite radical chic and achieving near-celebrity status, their militancy threatened the establishment. What never got much attention was the organization's community outreach, such as free breakfast for children and education programs. The Panthers raised awareness of institutional racism and the routine violence against blacks by police departments. The group did much to instill a sense of pride and resistance among many African Americans. Key to their strategy was using the media to get out their ideas through photo ops, press conferences, marches, and demonstrations. The media, in turn, framed the Panthers.